Welcome, welcome here to Show 82 on Crypto Voices. Matthew Majinsk is your host. Today here from Estonia, joined today by our special guest from Hong Kong, Dave Chapman. Dave is Executive Director of BC Group. It is headquartered in Hong Kong, as I mentioned, and it is also Asia's leading and only publicly traded tech and digital asset company. There's a lot to talk about today. Really looking forward to chatting with him and having him here. So Dave, thanks a lot for joining and welcome.
Matthew, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate it. We had a couple of false starts. It's actually our first pod that we've done with someone so many time zones away into the East, into Asia. So really think we can garner a lot of tidbits here for our listeners today. So really looking forward to it. Just a few questions, I guess, to begin on your background. I understand your role was in traditional finance, your prior life, so to speak. So can you tell us a little bit about that, your journey, and how you got into Bitcoin and crypto?
Yeah, sure, Matthew. And thanks again for the inclusion and for accommodating the time zone difference between ourselves and Estonia. If I go back to my pre-Bitcoin days, I was predominantly involved with investment banks and hedge funds and technology. And so I was born and raised in Australia, and I moved to London post graduating university, and quickly became fascinated with investment banking and traditional finance, and admittedly mainly from a financial remuneration perspective. And I was fortunate enough to break into the investment banking scene, where I was working for Bear Stearns until it collapsed. And I did some other consultancies and work and efforts for the likes of Credit Suisse, Barclays Capital, ABN AMRO, and then finally HSBC. And it was at these roles that I was working at, predominantly within the derivatives asset class. And so I was responsible for implementing low-latency trading platforms, pre- and post-trade risk systems, and whatnot. And after living in London for seven fabulous years, I was afforded the opportunity to move to Hong Kong with HSBC. And so that was in 2010. Took the opportunity, moved to HSBC, where I was managing the derivatives development teams for HSBC Asia. Was enjoying my time there. And then for my sins, I was fortunate enough to discover Bitcoin in 2012, late 2012. I think I originally discovered it and had the same reaction as many others, was a little bit confused, a little bit miffed, but I was certainly attracted to the decentralized nature of Bitcoin. And admittedly, Matthew, a little bit scared, to be honest. Up until that point, we had used peer-to-peer technologies like uTorrent or BitTorrent and so on. And this was the first technology that I had at least come across that didn't rely on a central server or an intermediary or a middleman. And so that was an interesting thing back in the days of when I was going through university and beyond. You know, Napster and eDonkey and all these different file sharing technologies, they were becoming quite popular. And whilst I'm not sure I agreed with the intent of illegally sharing music and movies, what fascinated me to those specific technologies was the peer-to-peer nature of it. And so when I discovered Bitcoin, it was definitely the next leg up. And that's what fascinated it to me initially. So when I discovered it, as I said, I was quite confused about, but attracted to it. In late 2012 or early 2013, I did what most people did back in those days, and you know, open an account with Mt. Gox, wired money to Japan, started transferring and sending the Bitcoin around from other people who were equally either curious or using it to transfer value in weird and wonderful ways. I was fortunate enough that a friend and colleague of mine, Hugh Madden, who was also working with at HSBC at the time, was also equally attracted to this technology. And so in the latter half of 2013, Hugh, myself, and another gentleman, Ken Lowe, we decided to either either permanently or temporarily at least park our traditional careers and, right. And move into crypto full time.
Nice. And so that was late 2013, early 2014.
So yeah, late 2013, the three of us started a cryptocurrency exchange in Hong Kong under the name of ANX. And from there, we started enabling a number of services. Should I continue, Matthew, or have you got questions so far?
No, it's okay. I mean, how did you guys feel about that timing, specifically around sort of the Asian markets at that time? Obviously, that was one of the first major booms and busts. Yeah, December 2013. How did that feel going into 2014?
Yeah, I think you could either say that you know we were brave or we were silly or a combination of them both. I mean, back in these days, you know, no one really knew whether Bitcoin was going to be permitted. You know, in Hong Kong, we're sitting so close to the likes of China and other jurisdictions that have capital controls. A lot of people did look at Bitcoin saying, okay, how is it being used? How is it being controlled? And so, you know, at the time, as I said, probably it's probably equal parts, you know, bold as well as a little bit, you know, I wouldn't say silly, I'd say adventurous is probably the right word, to move into a space that was, you know, admittedly unregulated. And it doesn't matter whether it's Bitcoin or digital assets or any other new asset class, there's definitely a element of risk moving into anything that doesn't have a playbook around it. And so admittedly, you know, a lot of the people that viewed Bitcoin back in the early, you know, 2014, even late 2013, a lot of people were very reluctant and very hesitant to get involved in an asset class that was unregulated, wasn't licensed, you know, didn't have, you know, at the time, credible partners or credible players in this space. So it was an interesting time. It was a fun time. Certainly one that we don't regret.
It's obviously always constantly evolving up until today, the regulatory space. I certainly want to talk about some of that, but maybe let's just launch forward to today with BC Group from the early days until now. How would you describe BC Group? Is it a fintech company? Is it a Bitcoin company, crypto company? Is it a blockchain company? Is it a broker?
To embark on the journey of BC Group and OSL, I'll probably have to go back a step, is that throughout the course of the 5 years, you know, or from 2013 leading forward, we started a number of different businesses. We had a cryptocurrency exchange. We were white labeling our technology so people could actually use our exchange tech and our matching engine capabilities for themselves. And then we also started a OTC trading desk called Octagon Strategy that quickly became the largest OTC trading desk in Asia as a result of offering what we would consider very professional services in brokering large tickets in the likes of Bitcoin and Ethereum, but also being fortunate and credible enough to have formal banking arrangements for that business. You know, if anyone that's not new to this space, you know, obviously at the time, banking has been one of the pain points in operating in crypto, given the fact that, as we touched on, it is largely unregulated. It is difficult to find, you know, payment processes that will accept you. And as a result of the practices we put in place, our transparency and whatnot, we were afforded formal banking arrangements, which allowed one of the reasons why that Octagon strategy became the success that it did so quickly. The challenge we faced, though, Matthew, is that you know, for some of our counterparts, whilst they respected what we were doing, they saw us as a professional outfit. The reality is, for some of these larger counterparts, you know, we were a credit risk as a result of not being licensed, not being regulated. So it was a little bit of a frustrating journey, given that we were doing the best we could at the time, but we had to find a solution on how do we, you know, how do we overcome and achieve or put ourselves into some form of regulation. And at the end of 2017 and the beginning of 2018, you know, the likes of my two co-founders and also alongside a very strategic investor, we took controlling stake of a mainboard listed entity on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, subsequently now known as BC Group. And we explained to those that we needed to how we would leverage the last, you know, 6 years of our experience in the blockchain and digital asset space, and we would build new businesses as a subsidiary of that listed company. And so that's what we've been building out now for the last 23 months. And it's put us into, you know, we are obliged and we operate by the same, you know, reporting or financial reporting obligations as any other main board listed company. And that's the one of the reasons why we undertook this journey was to provide more transparency, better credibility, and more legitimacy to the counterparts that we were interfacing with. And that's one of the ironies of you know, blockchain or the digital asset space, is that, you know, one of these massive technical advantages is all about transparency. But if you look at the continual failures in the you know, the digital asset space, it's really since inception, transparency has not been a very strong point of a lot of the participants in this space. And then, you know, it's definitely improving, but it was one of the reasons why we undertook and moved ourselves into a main board listed company. But rather than talk about the reasons why we did it and answer your question specifically, OSL is the subsidiary of BC Group and focuses on the digital asset component of the group. And we focus along four main pillars. We operate a brokerage, which still a brokerage that facilitates OTC transactions, and we are also moving into some other products there as well. We also have our own exchange technology with, you know, arguably one of the world's fastest matching engines, a suite of compliance tools that can, you know, quarantine tokens and coins in real time if they're deposited from the likes of the dark web or an exchange hack. We have transaction monitoring on our matching engine so we can identify, you know, the spoofing of orders and whatnot. So there's the brokerage, there's the exchange. Earlier this year, we launched our digital asset custody business. So this is a fully audited and fully insured custody service. And as I'm sure every one of your listeners can attest to, it's an area which has a very poor track record in this space. We've talked a little bit about transparency. If we talk about the number of clients and customers and consumers who have lost funds as a result of, you know, storing their assets on third-party exchanges, it's definitely been one of the critical areas in this space that needed to be fixed. And quite frankly, we believe that we have fixed it. And to be fair, we aren't the only vendor in this space that has now provided this, but we were the first in Asia, and I believe second in the world after Coinbase, to be afforded 100% insurance on both our hot and cold wallet infrastructure. So we're quite proud about that. And then finally, Matthew, we white label all our technology. So if someone wants to use our systematic RFQ function in our brokerage, or they would like to use our aggregated liquidity and matching engine through our exchange, or they want to actually white label custody as a service, they can do that across any of those pillars that we operate in.
Very impressive. I think you touched on, obviously, the myriad of challenges that you know, a crypto company faces through the years, and it seems like you guys have always been trying to do it the right way. My question, though, is how do you feel the environment is towards both retail and institutional clients, and how are your products geared toward each group? Do you focus on one more than the other?
That's a really good question, Matthew. And you know, our roots, you know, when we left our traditional jobs and careers in 2013, we were focusing on a real retail demographic. And you know, unfortunately, as things have evolved, you know, with the likes of regulation and the products and services that we offer, it really is, at this point in time, we cater for the non-retail demographic. So our typical counterparts are high net and ultra high net worth individuals, funds, family offices, asset managers, private banks, investment banks. You know, unfortunately, Matthew, this asset class is still largely considered a high risk, and for that reason, sure, for now, our services are focused on a non-retail demographic. And you know, I think it is unfortunate that is the case, but you know, if we want to take this industry forward, if we want to push it into the institutional space and make those changes at some point drip feed down into retail, unfortunately, that's the stance we've had to take for now.
everybody has a little bit of different stories about how the regulators react to their business model regarding your products and services that you're offering these institutional clients, then, you know, obviously we've seen sort of a breakout in futures contracts over the last year or two with the CME. And CME, I believe, does, you know, around 25,000 Bitcoins a day.
Yep.
Backed, maybe has been growing actually after a slow start, maybe 20% of that already. How does that sort of market look for you guys, both in terms of volumes and in terms of the products? You're looking at options, you're looking at other things.
It's definitely one step at a time for us. You know, I would say, I can confidently say that, you know, the likes of the CME Futures and BAX's recent and growing successful launch are largely complementary to ourselves. You know, if we look at what's happening in Hong Kong, in November, the SFC announced their virtual asset licensing framework, and you know the SFC had announced this 12 months earlier as a sandbox. This year, they came out and said that this is going ahead, and they would be accepting applications. You know, the license itself is, I would say, considered somewhat restrictive by some in terms of what sort of products you can offer and who they can be targeted towards. The reality is that whilst that view could be correct in some people's minds, the reality is you've got a regulator in a credible and legitimate jurisdiction that has been innovative enough to actually provide a framework around security tokens. That was probably one of the interesting things that when the SFC did announce it, you know, 12 months ago, is that there were a lot of people saying, you know, why is it the SFC? Why is it the Securities and Futures Commission? Why is it not the Hong Kong Monetary Authority? And largely the Hong Kong Monetary had come out earlier, actually years earlier, and said that Bitcoin is not considered money, therefore they didn't see a focus to regulate it. Whereas on the SFC side, you know, they have also stated that the likes of Bitcoin and Ethereum is not a security, but however, that they have been innovative enough to provide a framework around, you know, what a lot of people have termed to be this next big move in the digital asset space, which is security tokens. So, yes, I mean, to answer your question, you know, around the products and services that are offered around the licensing framework that is being considered right now. You know, for us, we are pro-regulation. As much as we respect the libertarian roots of Bitcoin and what it sets out to achieve, the reality is this is an asset class that's only $200 billion. If we truly want it to grow to a $5 trillion asset class in the next 3 to 5 years, unfortunately or fortunately, we're going to have to play by the rule books of traditional finance. And that's really the sector that we're geared towards. You know, we are engaging and having active dialogue and engagement with, you know, traditional finance, with investment banks, with private banks, with brokers. And, you know, there is a role for someone like ourselves with the credibility and legitimacy of a, you know, main board listed company, with being Big Four audited, with fully insurance and applying for licenses in this space. You know, we don't intend or expect to be a Binance. We're not competing with Bitmax. What we're really focusing on is the non-retail demographic and institutional play.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about there. Maybe I should just back up one step, because most of our listeners know, you know, most of the people we interview, the things we talk about primarily focus around Europe, US, Latin America, and Asia. We obviously, there's so much going on there, and I do want to touch on China and ICOs and cryptocurrency trade bans and things like that, but that's actually, I want to have that aside from this question.
Sure.
Regarding, you know, things that you are doing, institutional investors trying to legitimize it in the eyes of you know, new finance, fintech, everything. Is there any primary difference, like one or two differences? Because obviously you have some experience in London as well, as you mentioned, between, say, the Asian markets and the Western markets. Is there anything interesting you see there, one or two differences?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm going to be a little bit biased, but Asia really is at the center of growth in terms of digital assets and blockchain technology. You know, this region leads in terms of usage, it leads in terms of investment in digital assets, blockchain job growth, you know, technological innovation. You know, I think there was a study done not so long ago where, according to Accenture, you know, the Asia-Pacific region overtook North America in 2018 to become the leading destination of fintech fundraising. You know, it's you know, there's a whole bunch of things here that's happening in Asia, and sometimes they're not so well publicized or promoted. But especially even from a regulatory perspective, I know that your listeners are probably rolling their eyes when I'm bringing regulation back in. But when we see what's happening in the particular jurisdictions, like Japan now has, you know, 19 licensed venues, you know, and we're seeing in Hong Kong and other neighboring countries,
Korea,
exactly. And so it definitely has it just seems to be moving faster. That's probably what I would say. You know, we travel quite regularly to the US. We travel around Europe, and we have a presence in both the regions that I just mentioned. And so they're still very important jurisdictions. I think, you know, I'll admit to say that, you know, we were probably very lucky to have started where we did and stumbled across that just by sheer luck and of love for Hong Kong and for Greater Asia. And as a result, it has actually turned out to be quite a fortunate region for us to operate in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, on the surface, I recognize everything you say there, but one of the things that always comes to mind for, I don't know, say a Westerner is China.
Yeah.
And we have in October, I have it in my notes here, October 25th, Xi Jinping announced, you know, that he was embracing blockchain. It made it onto all the, you know, the main Chinese newspapers and sort of legitimized, at least permissioned blockchains in China. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this after, you know, banned ICOs back in September 2017, banned trading. Mining was sort of on and off banned for many years. If there's all these tailwinds for many other Asian markets, I'm wondering how you might be able to square that with what's happening with China. It's a big, broad question.
It's a fair question, given how bullish I am on Asia, Matthew.
Sure.
I mean, you know, China was the largest markets in the digital asset space, and that was until, obviously, China halted their regulations. And this isn't the first time where we've seen China take a negative view on public blockchain, and you know, it's probably not the last time. Sometimes it's very confusing as to what the regulation does exist in China. But I think, you know, admittedly, in this last episode of regulatory clarity, they've made it quite firm as to what you can and can't do right now. You know, I think China's stance has always really been about better understanding the challenges and risks of blockchain technology and what that might pose to risks in destabilizing China's own sovereign currency. But, you know, the PBOC has had ongoing initiatives for blockchain-based digital currency or digital-based renminbi since 2014. And so when President Xi does you know, come out here or makes the announcement that they want to be more innovative, they do want to move ahead with this digital RMB, it's a very fair question that you're asking, Matthew. What does that mean for the public blockchains? But I think, you know, especially with China, they have had a, you know, if we look at other asset classes and other technological advances in the region, they have always had quite a reserved view, and they would like to better understand the technology before they adopt it. But, you know, equally at the same time, if we look at, you know, when Libra was announced and obviously through the Western world, it was sending shockwaves and saying, oh my God, we're going to have a technology company that's potentially going to take over our payments. China had already done that. If you look at WePay and Alipay and so on, this is a nation that has so quickly adopted digital payments. And I think, you know, with the adoption of the introduction of this digital RMB, are there going to be concerns around privacy and taxation and so on? For sure. But I think at the same time, whilst the current regulatory stance is that public blockchains such as Bitcoin are banned in China, I wouldn't be saying that that's the nail in the coffin for public blockchains. I would be saying it's the nail in the coffin for now until they better understand it and better able to provide some controls around the public blockchain space. And I think that's probably telling of some jurisdictions, not just China as well.
Yeah, fair answer. Maybe a hard question, though, to follow. Do you have any sort of a timeline or any sort of a Can you read the tea leaves that it may change in the near future, or do you think it'll be a while? Do you think it'll be a short while or a long while?
I've made some very fortunate and accurate predictions in my time publicly, and I've made some very horrible predictions. So I'm generally quite reserved when it comes down to making predictions at all. However, to not shy away from the question, I would expect. I would anticipate that we see the actual launch, or at least the pilot of the digital RMB come into effect in the first quarter, if not the first half of next year. Now, I know that doesn't answer your question. Where that would leave the likes of Bitcoin and public blockchains, I think, you know, maybe the second half of next year we start seeing more clarity on how they can either be reintroduced or maybe a playbook as to what it further means for China.
And it's all coming front and center. You know, Agustin Carstens, the former governor of the Bank of Mexico, chairman of the BIS, he said, you know, we can't be left behind, something to that effect last week. Definitely wants to be in the forefront of central bank digital currencies. Mark Carney as well from the Bank of England at Jackson Hole, we talked about this on prior shows, you know, said that we need to be looking towards central bank digital currencies as sort of a global basket. But it's interesting because I always look at that, because these statements come from Western central bankers, and I look at that as saying, well, we know that China is coming on very, very strong, and we want to make sure that we have on the Western side like some innovation to counter the force, as you've, I think, alluded to, that is just coming with China. So it is a very interesting thing, these competing global central bank digital currencies, how that might work out globally between central banks.
It's definitely interesting as to, you know, the poker it put up some people's bottoms in terms of when China announced they were going to release a digital currency. It definitely expedited, I think, a lot of the other jurisdictions saying, okay, this is really happening. We can't lose our advantage in technology innovation, and in some jurisdictions, you know, we can't become we can't lose the grip of being the world's preferred favorite currency. So it definitely created a lot of expedited scrutiny around this space, and I think that was one of the things that that also happened when Libra was announced with Facebook and its, you know, its founding partners around the Libra currency. You know, I for one, you know, have mixed views on Facebook and what they provide in terms of services, but you can't deny that their reach is, you know, through Facebook and its subsidiaries and Instagram and Oculus and WhatsApp. You know, their reach is a quarter of the world's population, and so when someone comes out and says, "Oh, we're gonna have a payment token that can disrupt, you know, payment processing and currency as we know it." It scares a lot of people. I mean, it probably scared a different group of people in the same way that Bitcoin scared people. You know, with Bitcoin, you didn't have an intermediary. With the likes of Libra, you are completely disrupting and dislocating the traditional payment network, and that makes them extremely scared. But, you know, for me, if someone was to say, you know, was I happy about Libra being announced? I was delighted. But I was delighted because in my mind, it expedited the adoption of digital currency so much faster. And is the user experience of me being able to pay you, Matthew, through WhatsApp going to be sexier and more seamless than Bitcoin? For now, 100%. But imagine when someone is trying to make a payment through WhatsApp or through Facebook and it's stopped. Now, it could be stopped legitimately for very legitimate reasons, or it might just be stopped because Facebook don't want to process that payment. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that is going to happen, but it could be the penny drop moment as to why Bitcoin could be so much better understood and received. Overall, I think the future is very bright, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's Libra. I do think that there are some very obvious discussion points around government-issued digital currencies, but I think it's moving and progressing at a much faster rate than what has happened, at least in the last 6 years of myself being in this business.
You actually sort of predicted or anticipated my next question, because we are, you know, a Bitcoin-focused podcast primarily, and though I think it's fascinating to look at the the views of these various regulators, central bankers, both in the East and the West. In general, maybe just having the Bitcoin views that we do, at least on our show, we feel pretty comfortable with all that it means for Bitcoin. And if anything, kind of look at these central bank decisions as sort of knee-jerk or even showing a little bit of weakness.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily strength as far as like stabilizing the system. And obviously everybody's been questioning that in the last 10 years since the financial crisis. But my question would be, where do you see Bitcoin sitting in all of this, you know, next couple of years?
Before I answer that question, what the other obvious, you know, point of some of these discussions that are going on, I'm sure it's frustrating for the likes of yourself and myself and your listeners with just watching some of the conversations and how they play out. And frankly, and unfortunately, in some of these jurisdictions and in some of these conversations, it's just the wrong people dealing with it. And it's just, you have a million people face-palming their faces when you see some of the comments and some of the hearings that are going on and some of the questions that are being asked. It's just, yeah. It's mind-blowing. And it's very unfortunate, but, unfortunately, we're probably going to have to deal with that. With respect to your question, where do I see Bitcoin sitting in all of this? Well, I mean, at the moment, every major central bank and government is looking at digital currencies with great intent and focus, but there is no one still saying, "Well, this is the global currency. This is the currency that's going to be borderless." Now, Libra definitely shares some of those attributes, but they had stated that it's still going to be controlled and governed, in a through a partner model, I still see Bitcoin as still being that original, the original ability to transfer value 24/7, 7 days a week, without a central intermediary. And everyone's like, "Okay, well done, Dave. You've just defined Bitcoin. Well done." But really, at its core, that's what it is. Bitcoin. Obviously, we have an enormous amount of altcoins and coins that are designed to do different things. Bitcoin still has 67% dominance of this still very tiny $200 billion market cap. It has that first use case. It has that brand and that network effect. It is by far the most secured network in the world. And I'm not silly enough to say that it's going to be the best forever. But I have difficulty in thinking how it would be dethroned in the next 5 years, if not the next decade. And so where it sits, it's for me, in my perspective, it's still that one single currency that could, you could be integrated, could be, you have interoperability with all these other government-issued digital currencies that can create a payments rails potentially into Libra and back the other way. But Bitcoin's still going to be that borderless, that one global currency that allows people to transfer value in any circumstance. And I think that's a very powerful use case.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously we ask a similar type question to most all of our guests. It means many things to many people. And whether you call it a speculative store of value or the true digital currency or truly censorship resistant compared to all the others, I think, I think it's got a lot of things going for it in light of, as I mentioned, seemingly regulatory headwinds, or at least not necessarily still very friendly and open to Bitcoin. They'd rather build their own thing at the moment.
I know this will go down in history as being potentially one of the most regulatorily focused podcasts, which isn't great for your listening views, Matthew. I'm sorry, but I mean, when we talk about adoption of Bitcoin, if I try and get it back onto a topic that people do want to hear about, the good news is that we're engaging with Tier 1 investment banks who want to understand better how they, if we look at the journey that has happened over the last 6 years, Bitcoin came out, banks are like, "Oh, we don't want to touch it." And then traditional finance changed their views and said, "Oh, well, it's all about blockchain, but Bitcoin's bad, blockchain's good."
Yep.
Now, the interesting thing now is that it's almost that some of the more innovative participants from traditional finance have actually woken up to the fact that there is value in some shape or form of private blockchains. But the reality is that their customers are wanting to trade Bitcoin. They're wanting to trade public blockchains. And so the good news is to hopefully provide some positivity on a very regulatory focused podcast is the fact is that we are engaging with traditional private banks, traditional investment banks who are routing orders to our desk, who are wanting to use our infrastructure so they can actually offer this product to their clients. And so that is quite telling. I think that's also very, very positive. Yes, we're seeing an enormous amount of regulation where it's all about private blockchains and all about, state-controlled digital currencies. But the reality is there is still a previously unseen demand for traditional finance who want to enter this asset class. And I think that that's probably one of the positive spins I can put about on regulation is that, we had a number of reasons why traditional finance didn't want to enter this space. There's many, many reasons, but the two biggest were lack of regulatory clarity and lack of quality custodians. And so when we see the likes of, Fidelity enter this space, and we see the types of infrastructure that Coinbase and OSL have, and it's fully insured and it's audited by a Big Four auditor, it's actually providing less and less obstacles as to why traditional finance can't enter this space. And unfortunately, regulatory clarity is one of those things that's preventing it. And so whilst listeners are probably shaking their head in disgust when I keep talking about regulation. Unfortunately, it's one of those pieces of the puzzle that we're going to have to swallow, at least for now and for the foreseeable future, if we want this asset class to grow.
And it's a good point regarding some of the institutional appetite, I think, in response to some of the other things we've been talking about. Let's bring it back maybe then to some of your products and some of the demand for some of your clients. This is sort of actually meant to be a long question, so feel free to take as long as you need in the answer. But I'm curious, comparing sort of two types of products, say Bitcoin specifically, futures, options, derivatives. There's a lot of action, as we talked about earlier, that's happening there. It's growing. It's increasing. Institutional interest is definitely growing. And then maybe compare that, and this isn't meant to be loaded for our altcoin friends, but compare that to some other use cases you might see. Obviously, I know you deal with more than just Bitcoin. You have, whether it's utility tokens, stable coins, whatever it may be, decentralized finance products, I don't know. So a long question, or meant for a long answer, Dave. How do your clients look at Bitcoin-specific financial products, options, futures, derivatives, and then how does that compare with their demand for altcoin products?
Really good question. Hopefully the answer won't be too long, Matthew. But I mean, our demographic of counterpart really does vary. As I said, we predominantly service, high net and ultra high net worth individuals, funds, family offices, asset managers and whatnot. So the demand for the type of products that we offer them might not just be, a spot OTC trade. It might be, it could be a product that is very catered for their needs. But I mean, for a lot of the clients or counterparts that we service as well, I mean, they're trading this asset class because it is volatile. And so they could be, arbitraging between another exchange. They could be arbitraging with a market that we don't service. So I think, I don't think that's so different from traditional finance. People are going to find a way to make money. They'll look at different products. And if there's volatility, that's an added bonus. With respect to, non-Bitcoin products. Yep. I mean, obviously, we trade all the majors and whatnot. I think for the altcoin listeners out there, I'll be honest and put my hand on my heart and say that there are months when our largest volume isn't always Bitcoin. It's typically always Bitcoin, but there are certainly months that we will have where a non-Bitcoin product like Ethereum or Ripple or whatnot is the largest traded by volume. So it's not always Bitcoin, as some of your listeners might think. With respect to another type of product, I mean, an interesting thing that we keep hearing about, and the narrative has been used for probably almost 18 months to 24 months now, is the likes of security tokens. If we go back and wind back to what we saw in 2017 with this hyperbolic ICO phase, I mean, you can't deny that there was no faster way to raise capital than to do an ICO. And you know, were there some unsavory actors in that space? For sure. But that's, you know, that's the same. That's going to be the case with any new technology. But you can't deny that ICOs really were Kickstarter on steroids, and for a lot of people, they were able to raise an insane amount of money by doing a token sale. But so whilst you can't deny that the technology worked, obviously right now we're seeing people and saying, okay, well, is there a legitimate use case? Is there a real use case that, you know, I can raise capital and it is going to be a security? I'm not going to suggest it's going to be a utility or it's a product redemption or it's membership, that it is actually going to represent equity in a company. And can I use the advantages of, you know, a smart contract on a platform, whether it's Ethereum, whether it's Tezos, Consensus, you know, there's Securitize, there's a number of, you know, what I would consider to be very good vendors out in the market right now trying to achieve and resolve or provide a good service that will actually potentially either complement at its very least or disrupt and dislocate at its very best traditional capital raising initiatives. So is there going to be an asset class or is there going to be a service that disrupts or replaces initial public offerings? I don't think it's going to replace, but I do think that there's actually a market where if someone was wanting to raise capital in an efficient manner, maybe not as largely sized as an IPO, but wanting to do it through a token sale, there's some of the engagements that we're having with traditional finance. Now that's what is interesting to us right now.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting, you know, a new next generation sort of corporate structure, corporate equity being linked to, you know, to a blockchain token, whatever the protocol may be. Sort of in line of prior questions related to Asia versus the West, do you see Asia as leading the way there? Do you think that this is green pastures for Asia?
That's a good question, Matthew. From my perspective, I mean, we've engaged with a number of the vendors who were fortunate enough to have Asian-based teams. I think, you know, again, technology is one piece. Trying to be in a jurisdiction where they formally recognize security tokens is another challenge. It's actually just as large, if not larger, than the technology itself. You know, I think if I recall, Liechtenstein, you know, has come out with some innovative regulation that comes into effect next year. And whilst it's not typically known as a very large jurisdiction, obviously it's innovative. Obviously, with what we saw in Hong Kong, with the Securities and Futures Commission, with their virtual asset framework, you know, apply to STOs. Obviously, we're very bullish on the region here. But that doesn't mean, you know, we can't utilize and leverage the technology from a non-Asia based vendor. So I guess the short answer there is watch this space.
Back to Bitcoin. Do you still see it as sort of, again, that speculative store of value with most of the instruments, or is there any activity in perhaps some of these Blockstream products, you know, via the Liquid side chain? Are you looking at any sort of Bitcoin-specific smart contracting-like platforms at all?
So specifically for us, I mean, it's a space that we'll always be looking at. You know, we've got a large number of technologists and developers here that are definitely keen to understand what is the best route and seeing what's happening in terms of market adoption. You know, I'm definitely not going to talk negatively of any type of innovation. I mean, if someone's out there trying to make something, build something, then great. Let's you know, kick the tires. Let's see how it works. I mean, if you're looking at the recent developments on the Lightning Network, I mean, it was an interesting achievement last week. We saw one of the first exchanges actually enable Lightning deposits. You know, I mean, I applaud them. My hat goes off to them, regardless of who they are or their reputation. The fact that they're doing something as innovative as enabling Lightning deposits and payment in, payment out services, fantastic. Now, how does that compete with something like Liquid, and how does that compete with RSK, who are trying to write smart contracts? I mean, I guess the good thing about this space is that, to a large degree, everyone builds what they want, and it's whoever builds it best or whatever is adopted first has that sort of unfair advantage, as we've seen with some of these technologies such as Tether. But the reality is that it's still this whole asset class is so much in its infancy, and there is a lot of collaboration, and obviously it's setting new standards across technology as a whole. You imagine before, you know, before the likes of digital currencies like Bitcoin and whatnot, and you could probably apply this to, you know, Linux and Unix being open source networks. I mean, if you go back probably 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was the open source software was not really, it was definitely nowhere near the popularity and dominance that it is today. And so what I do think is, as a result of, you know, people wanting to not rely on trust, but actually wanting to see the inner workings of something and promoting open source, I think that in itself has probably been the biggest technological revolution over the last 20 years. We've moved away from very closed proprietary software that you're at the mercy of a vendor, to now actually relying on the vendor for their added support services as opposed to actually buying a software license for something that you never get to see. And so I guess, you know, I mean, that's a very long answer. It's a little bit wishy-washy. I guess in terms of, you know, you asked about different products. From my perspective, whether there's upside or downside, negatives or positives, from my perspective, one very obvious positive is the fact that, you know, as a community, we've now evolved to a point where the software has to be open, and you do need to see it. And so, you know, on these, you know, at least at these protocol levels.
One more, I think, regarding your products, your exchange, your clients. Very curious, it's sort of a current question as well. You know, who's buying, who's selling that you see? And this doesn't have to be Bitcoin only. This can be whatever product you might want to highlight. But who's buying and who's selling when it comes to digital assets?
We do have a number of, you know, passive-only tracking funds that will buy and hold Bitcoin, and they may use their own custody in some cases. In most cases, they'll use our custody as a result of having, you know, military-grade DoD certified Faraday cages, as a result of having insurance, and as a result of it being audited. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of infrastructure that goes into operating this type of organization that wants to attract those types of clients. But in terms of who would be our largest, demographic of customer, it would be very, very difficult to say, Matthew. We still have an enormous amount of, you know, high net, ultra high net worth, you know, accredited professional traders. I mean, I wouldn't say that we have one side long only or one way or the other. I mean, it is very diverse, and furthermore, and probably more appropriate, it changes very frequently.
Hedging is coming to the fore now with all these products in crypto. I mean, it's completely different than when you got started in 2013, 2014.
100%.
Interesting. I think I'd like to maybe ask you a couple questions. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you where you're locally based here in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And we're speaking here on Monday morning, December 9th, and there was major peaceful big protests, sort of marking the six month anniversary of these protests. 800,000 strong, as far as I could tell, though I guess the police reported differently. We should remember that these protests were sparked in light of extradition bills that Hong Kong was planning to enact with mainland China. Those have since been rescinded, so that's a victory, I think, for the people there. I don't want to be too political about these questions, but I do have a series of questions for you. I mean, the first one: what is it like to be working in Hong Kong?
Sure. Hong Kong remains my home. it's the best city that I've ever had the pleasure of residing in. Hong Kong is an extremely special place. It's extremely dynamic. It's cultural. And also in terms of physical size, it is quite a small city, and so that in itself gives it some very unique properties that actually make it very enjoyable to live here. I've lived in a number of other cities around the globe, and I've visited many, many cities. But Hong Kong definitely remains true to my heart, definitely remains my home, and I definitely have no intentions of leaving despite the current unrest.
Is it something that you sort of notice day to day, what has been happening? Obviously, you know, I don't check in every day, but there's been major periods in the last 6 months where it seems like there has been some unrest, and, you know, how has it been?
I think I'd lose all credibility if I was to sit here and say, no, everything's fine. I don't know what you're talking about. There isn't any unrest. Of course there's unrest. I think it's an extremely sensitive and delicate situation right now. I mean, from my perspective, though, as well, is that, you know, I do get a lot of, you know, a lot of friends, business acquaintances and relatives who have asked me over the past 6 months, is Hong Kong still safe? And my answer is undeniably, it is safe. It's you know, it's one of the things that we see when the media portray certain events. And, you know, sure, the things that you're seeing on TV have happened, but they also sometimes focus on the more negative and short-lived and very short-fueled events that unfold, that are repeatedly shown on Western media. And what they fail to show is that, for the large part, these demonstrations are peaceful. I can't think of anywhere else on the planet where you could have 1 million people protesting for the far majority of the demonstrations that have taken place in a very largely peaceful manner. You know, if we look at what's happened in Paris, where, you know, and other areas where, you know, there is an enormous amount of destruction that occurs as a result of these protests, and it's something that you don't see here. So, you know, it's regardless of your particular stance, what I would like your viewers to know and understand is that if they were thinking about coming to Hong Kong and not visiting as a result of the unrest, I would strongly urge them to reconsider. As a result, you know, I recently I had my parents visit, and they, you know, their friends and family thought they were not taking the situation seriously, and I assured them that if you come out here, you'll see for yourself that it's still a very safe and still a fantastic place to visit, and so on. And I think on a closing note on that topic, I mean, you know, the situation is ongoing. We're watching it closely, and as I said, it is a very sensitive topic. It is very delicate. I mean, what's interesting and how this applies to Bitcoin is that if you look around the geographical and political uncertainty in the world, it doesn't matter which part of the world you're in. If you're looking at what the events that are unfolding, it's probably actually providing, you know, a stronger use case for Bitcoin. You know, if we look at the continual financial failures, if we look at the political uncertainty with what's happening in the US and in Europe with Brexit, if we look at the geographical uncertainty with what's happening around the world, it probably is providing a very good use case, or at least a selling point as to why people might want to consider having some of their net worth in something as crazy as Bitcoin, as crazy as it sounds. And that's an interesting thing that's changed in the last 6 years. You know, as I'm sure you and your listeners will attest to, you know, if you told someone 6 years ago you had a portion of your net wealth in Bitcoin, the first response probably would have been, "What are you talking about?" Now, if you fast forward that through to maybe 2015, they would have known what you're talking about, but they'd say you were crazy. And the reality is now, if you tell someone that you have a portion of your net wealth in Bitcoin, the common response is, "That's cool. How do I do that?" And I think that's quite telling as to where we've come from over the, at least my very fortunate 6 years in this space.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very good way to end it, Dave. There's obviously a lot to cover there, too much to cover in this podcast, but I think certainly just little tales of freedom and Bitcoin always go together. So that's probably a good way to end it here. One last question as we close it then. Any sort of predictions, or what are you looking for in 2020, both with your company and in general in the markets?
I think from my perspective, 2020, if I was to try and make some foresight or some predictions, you know, very, very top level here. Traditional finance continues to invest. We'll see a lot of progression made by traditional banks, and I think specifically some Asian headquartered banks. I think the custody piece is largely solved, and we'll see a more dominant reliance on some of these quality custodians that are coming out. I think we'll see a bank launch a cryptocurrency exchange next year, which will be pretty massive. And then obviously, you know, the obvious one is that we're going to see, you know, more bank issued and government issued stable coins, similar to what we've already been seeing this year. But yeah, I mean, pretty safe predictions there, I think, Matthew. Nothing too scandalous. But on that note, I appreciate the time. I'm very appreciative of being the first Asian-based podcast interview, and really appreciate my time. And thank you most of all to the listeners of your show that have listened to our interview today.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully it's not the last. Definitely appreciate your time as well, Dave. For our listeners, as we close it, where can they find you? Any links, any places online you would like to share?
Yeah, for sure. My Twitter is I am Dave Chapman, all one word. And the company Twitter is osl.com, as in osl.com. And if you want to check out more on our products and services, you can go to osl.com.
Dave, thank you very much for the time. Our guest has been Dave Chapman from BC Group. Have a great end to 2019. All the best in 2020.
Thank you very much, Matthew.